Okay, I believe we're on the air. Hopefully we are anyway. In which case, good morning to you, wherever you are, or good afternoon. Potentially somewhere in the earth, it might be a sort of good evening, in which case, welcome to you too. Nothing much to say before we start, so we may as well bow our heads, ask God's blessing, and get right underway. Heavenly Father, we are grateful to you for giving us an understanding of the times we live in. Thank you for your scripture. Thank you for the word of prophecy. As we do examine this particular word today, we ask, please, you'll open up our minds, give us direction and the understanding we do need. And we ask for this blessing upon us. And thank you for it in advance. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Okay, then, brethren, for quite a few weeks now, we've been looking at the topic of prophecy. I guess we're all interested in seeing if we can understand the times we live in, if we can understand the world conditions, what's happening, where we're going, what might the Bible say about all of that. And I suppose, to be fair, many of us for decades have been endeavoring to watch world events and world news and try to interpret it in the light of prophecy. We've done that to one degree or another, and I think we'd all concede it's not particularly easy, is it? I mean, prophecy, let's face it, is a bit challenging. There are all these symbols, you know, heads and horns and mountains and toes, and what on earth does all this mean? And I think, again, to be fair, most of us traditionally in our years in and around the Church of God, at least, we've probably tended to focus on Europe, on Rome, usually on Germany, and we've sort of been looking for something along the lines of perhaps a 10-nation combination of countries in Europe, somehow coming together with some sort of charismatic leader who may be a German or may not, and this group of 10 nations will somehow associate with the Vatican or the papacy. And at some point, this 10-nation combine will wage war on the US and Britain and other countries, and somewhere along the line will enforce Catholic dogma in a revised Holy Roman Empire. This will continue till Christ returns, and that latter period of terrible suffering would be known as the Great Tribulation. But sort of, you know, roughly, I think, what most of us have believed and what we've traditionally been looking for when we examine world news. And that, of course, may be right. That is certainly the popular view. It's traditional within the Churches of God. It's also, to some extent, believed by quite a number of evangelical types out there. Yet, I think we've said, in some ways, you know, that doesn't look quite right. That's not really what we see when we look at Europe today. Europe today is not a terribly aggressive continent in many ways. It's got its own in-house problems to sort out. In terms of religion, really, Europe is very, very weak in terms of its religious attitudes. Here in the UK, there's something like now, I think, less than 1.5% of people attend the Church of England each Sunday. 1.5% of the population. Catholics is probably a wee bit similar. These are tiny, tiny numbers. Across in Europe, I think a recent telephone poll suggested about just under 10% of Germans attended church on Sundays, but this was a telephone poll. You know, do you go to church? Oh, yes, I do. I imagine if you actually counted, it'd be quite a bit less than 10% in Germany. And France is probably worse than that. So I would have thought, you know, realistically, you'd have to admit that the continent of Europe is really no longer even vaguely religious. It is a secular continent. the UK is a secular country. Some use the term Europe is now post-Christian, meaning that was history. We're now past the Christian era for Europe. So, yeah, things could change. There could be dramatic events. But as we stand here today, or actually sitting down here today, Europe, okay, let's continue to watch. But really, in the last half century, has very much really, really changed? Not, I think, as much as we'd expect in terms of prophetic development. Also, we said a few weeks ago, there are some biblical flaws. Not just a question of what does Europe look like when we examine it, but actually, how does the European Roman idea fit in terms of what the Bible actually says? And we saw Daniel 2:40, not going there, tells us that the fourth empire of Daniel's big metallic statue, the one that's iron, which we have thought might be Rome, the Roman Empire, Daniel 2:40 tells us that the fourth empire will break in pieces, destroy, crush, pulverize all the others that it replaces. That's what the Bible says. And of course, the weakness there with Rome is it didn't do that. Now, maybe there's a way to get around that. I don't personally see it. But that does seem to be quite a serious flaw in identifying that fourth iron empire as Rome. And then we asked, well, okay, if it's not Rome, if it's not Rome and Europe, is there a plausible alternative? Is there somewhere else that might be worth watching just in case Europe is the wrong answer? And the suggestion was, how about Islam and the Islamic realm? Because, for example, Islam is a major religious force on planet Earth. It has approximately 1.67 billion adherents. That's one quarter of the Earth. It has historically, traditionally, an aggressive approach. It has waged wars for approximately 1,400 years. And according to some numbers, you can attribute about 270 million deaths to Islamic Jihad. That's a lot. And that's not stopped. Since 9/11, there are in excess of 20,000 recorded jihadist attacks on the earth. So we have a aggressive, a major religious force. There have been major Islamic empires over that 1,400-year period, including not that far back, the Ottoman Empire, based in Turkey, but spread across into Europe, across the Middle East, into Arabia, across North Africa. And that empire, Islamic Empire, fought and ruled for about, 600 years. And even today, Islam has what they call, what some people call, a prime directive, which is to convert the whole world to Islam and Sharia law worldwide. So if you're thinking of a potential, plausible alternative that has the manpower, that has the underlying objective, which has the history, then Islam looks pretty promising. Then, of course, we've referred to quite some detail, the beheading. That's the cultural preference of Islam for dealing with their enemies. It's also Mohammed's preferred way himself personally. And it's in the Quran. And, of course, we saw that there's a reference in Revelation 20, verse 4, to those who are beheaded as martyrs to Christ. And if you're, you know, looking at the world on a week-to-week basis and thinking, you know, what's going on this week? Let's have a look at Europe. What's happened in Europe in the past 7 days? You'll find, typically, nothing that looks hugely relevant. But if you look at the Islamic world, well, how about this past week alone? So here's just four items I've picked up, just looking at some news today. So the point here I'm making is, in terms of activity, in terms of threats, in terms of capability, in terms of the will, Islam, it does look promising. This past week, in terms of jihad attacks, there was one on Tuesday, an Islamic bomb blast in Istanbul. 10 or 11 killed. I've seen different numbers. I think they were all Germans. We were there in that particular part of Istanbul back in October. It's called the Hippodrome area. We walked down that several evenings, several days. But an Islamic terrorist detonated a bomb and 10 killed. Okay. Thursday, 2 days later, Jakarta. Hopefully you've seen this in the news if you're watching. But on Thursday, half a dozen bomb and gun attacks. One was either in or close to a Starbucks coffee shop. And that's, you know, Islamic State, ISIS, has taken credit for that. Not too many killed there, although I think quite a few injuries. Most of those who were killed turned out to be, poetic justice, the terrorists themselves. And then today, literally in the last few hours, there is still possibly ongoing an Islamic attack in Burkina Faso, not a place I'm very familiar with, country in Western Africa, which has targeted foreigners, because that's really, in a sense, who they're often after. There appear to be between 23 and 27 killed today. I think over 100 hostages at one point have now been released. And that, again, is Islamic militants. So that's just like Tuesday to Saturday. And, I mean, every week you can see it there, the hostility, the hate, the religious fervor. Other news, well, this one is a bit more oblique, I think, in a sense. But today, I believe in Austria, in Vienna, we're going to see the ending of the sanctions against Iran. They are allegedly now complying with their halting their nuclear program, at least for a few years. If that's confirmed by the International Atomic Energy Authority, then sanctions end as of, I guess, today or a few hours' time, at which point Iran gets something like $100 billion or more returned to it. That's been frozen over the last several years. So what does that do? Well, we've seen, I think, that in Daniel chapter 8, we see the ram, or Iran, going out on a war-type rampage. That would be a lot easier if you've got $100 billion coming your way. So Mr. Obama was keen to have in his legacy that he brought some element of peace and security to the Middle East. So he's pushed through this sanctions relief in exchange for some promise about not making too many bombs in your backyard. Even though many people have said, you're going to let a tiger loose, Mr. Obama. So that's more news about, you know, these countries, these Islamic states, and hence, in a sense, I think, well worth watching. You'll see more activity there than we'll see in Europe. More, let's say, relevant activity than we'll see in Europe. But this is not just a question of, you know, just looking to see what's happening and working backwards into the Bible and saying, you know what, these Islamic countries are really, you know, they're really getting quite sort of hostile. There's lots of violence. They've got a strong desire to establish Islam worldwide. Let's see if we can find that in the Bible. It's not a question of working back into the Bible. The Bible itself pretty much points us, I think, that way. It specifically identifies Muslim countries. If you remember Daniel 2, and we're not turning there at the moment at least, you had this statue. The top of the statue in gold was Babylon or Iraq, because that's where it is today. Iraq is a Islamic country, Muslim country. The next one, the silver on the statue, was Medo-Persia, which today Persia is called Iran, which is, of course, Islamic. Then you had Greece and Turkey, the sort of the bronze, you know, belly and thighs. And, well, the Hebrew was Javan. We covered all this. It's probably what we mean today by Western Turkey and that part of the Middle East. Of course, Turkey is, again, a Muslim country. So even Daniel itself, the statue is, you know, gold, silver, bronze, Muslim, Muslim, Muslim. In Daniel 8, we spent nearly 2 weeks there. We have the ram running out on the rampage. The ram is, it says so in the chapter, it's Persia or Iran, which of course is Islamic. The he-goat that goes charging out and retaliates against the ram, we said was Turkey, heading up a confederacy, and of course Turkey is Islamic. So it's not a question of trying to read Islam into the scriptures. The actual countries that the Bible points to are today Islamic countries. And of course we said, you know, if Daniel 8 is for the end time, and I think we saw at least three verses that said it was, then you and I can know ahead of time that somewhere along the line, maybe soon, Iran is going to war across the Middle East. That's what it says. And from Daniel 8, we know that Turkey and some other countries are going to lead a counterattack. It's there. So if you look at Daniel 8, we don't see some sort of European nations going to war, which is our traditional sort of view. We actually see quite clearly, I don't think there's much argument about it, Daniel 8 shows us in the end time Islamic countries going to war. Now we'll turn to Daniel 9 in a moment. I want to finish off and recap a wee bit of where we were last week, but just in passing, I'm sort of trying to sort of demonstrate that really, you know, Islam is in the Bible, or at least, should I say, Islamic countries. You can't say Islam itself exactly, because when the scriptures were written, including the book of Revelation, whereby the Apostle John, Islam hadn't arrived yet. Islam came along in the 600s AD with Mr. Muhammad. But of course, the countries that we're going to look at in a moment, that Christ will fight against upon his return, rather strangely, seem to be Islamic countries. Okay? Because just look. So we're not going to read very far. It's only really one verse per chapter. I just want to add them up to give an impression. So you turn to Isaiah 13 and verse 1. This is in passing. This is not in depth. I just want to really sort of give a flavor of something I think you'll see when you're, you know, reading through prophecies, if you ever read through prophecies. If, of course, you ever read the Bible, but we ought to. It's there for our benefit, including the 25-33% that is prophecy. But here in Isaiah 13, 1, if you get there, it says the burden, my margin says the oracle, the prophecy, I guess a burden because very often it's pretty heavy. The burden against Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw. So the burden is against whom? What's this heavy, weighty message against? Babylon. Who's Babylon today? Iraq. What is Iraq? Muslim. Islamic. Okay. Turn to 15:1. Isaiah 15:1, that is. The burden against Moab. So here's the punishment coming at Christ's return, the end of the age, against Moab. Who's Moab? Well, we believe Jordan, which, of course, is Muslim. Okay, let's try 17:1. The burden, the weighty message of coming punishment against Damascus. Where's Damascus? Damascus is the capital of Syria. Damascus claims to be the oldest, longest-lived populated city on planet Earth. It goes back thousands of years, but it's going to end, as it says later on in that chapter. Damascus, Syria, Muslim. And it's going to be punished, as it says there. How about 19:1? The burden against Egypt. Was Egypt Islamic? Have a look at 21:13. The burden against Arabia. Arabia, yep, Islam. How about last 23:1? The burden, the weighty message of coming punishment upon Tyre. Where's Tyre? It's in Lebanon, which happens to be Islamic.
That's where John lives.
So, yeah, I know there's one in Missouri and Lebanon, but this is different. So,
we hope so.
Is it just coincidence? I mean, clearly, in one sense, all the nations that are mentioned here sort of surround Jerusalem geographically. So I guess it's not a surprise that they would be sort of mentioned. But they're going to be punished quite severely if you read the chapters there. Is it really that is such a surprise that all of those would be Islamic countries who are ruled by religion, which is the epitome of the spirit of Antichrist? Remember what Antichrist spirit is. What does it say in 1 John 2? It says, who is a liar but he that denies that Jesus is the Christ? And this is Antichrist who denies the Father and the Son. And guess what? 1.67 billion people and their religion deny the Father and the Son, deny that Jesus was Messiah, that he died and rose again. So I think that's just it's an aside, really, that the countries who are identified by name to be punished happen to be all coincidence or otherwise Islamic countries. Okay, let's turn now to Daniel 9, verses 25 to 27. I want to recap on last week, because I know we were running out of time. Well, I was. You might not have been, but I certainly was running out of time.
And got faster.
So I got a bit hurried, and I was accused of going too fast, which is probably true. but when you get excited, you tend to lose that sort of calm, slow demeanor, and you end up gambling. So Daniel 9 and 25 to 27. Remember, I'm sure, this is the 70 weeks prophecy. That was in verse 24. But 70 weeks doesn't mean 70 weeks. I'm not just saying that to be clever. The word translated weeks is Shabuah, which just means seven. So it's 70 sevens are determined, Daniel, on your people, and so on, right up to the end and the time of everlasting righteousness. And we believe, and I think it's fairly universally believed, but probably not totally universally believed, that these are 70 times 7 years, 490 years. But, of course, they come in different units. So I think we're picking up in verse 25. Know therefore and understand, Daniel, that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem, which was in ruins at this stage, until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street or the square shall be built again and the wall, even in troublesome times. And historically, it seems that the first 7 weeks or 49 years were taken up by the rebuilding of the ruins of Jerusalem and the rebuilding of a temple. Then, of course, we've got the next 62 weeks, which brings us up to Messiah the Prince. And that appears to bring us up to Jesus going public. He had been, of course, a young child, a young boy, a teenager, a young man. But when he was baptized and the Spirit descended upon him, then off he goes and begins his ministry. And that appears to be where the 62 weeks takes us. So we've been through all of that. Dropping down to verse 26. After the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And obviously that's referring to Jesus' crucifixion. And I think, again, most people seem fairly agreed on that point. It's just that this part, we tend to go off in at least two directions. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, which, again, most people accept is 70 AD, when Jerusalem and the temple were sacked and destroyed by General Titus of Rome and his Roman legions. But there's a possible little subtlety there we will look at in a moment. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Again, probably back in 70 AD. Then it gets a wee bit trickier, verse 27. Then he, which he, is this still Messiah the Prince? He, or is this the Prince of the people who is to come? He, okay. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, or 7 years, a Shabuah, but in the middle of the week, or at the 3.5 year point, in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wings of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate or the desolator. I think is more correct there. So it's really verse 27 that causes some dispute, because who is the he who confirms the covenant? Antichrist, which is what I was suggesting last week, or is it still talking of Messiah? Now, a very popular view is that this is talking of Jesus Christ, who will confirm, if you like, the new covenant. You know, Jesus was the messenger of the covenant. We know that. So this is said to be Jesus confirming his covenant, the new covenant, with many for 1 week, for a 7 year period. But in the middle of that 7 years, he brings an end to sacrifice by being himself sacrificed. And after Jesus is crucified, there's no more need for sacrifices. And so that brings it to an end. And it sort of pretty much brings this verse to a halt there at the halfway point. And then it sort of, apparently, I think, jumps to the abomination of desolation that comes next, which is, if you like, 2,000 years away from when Jesus is cut off. So that's sort of, like I say, a popular understanding, very popular. Of course, it leaves Jesus with still some confirming to do, because it says, if you take it this way, that Jesus confirms the covenant for 7 years. In the middle of that period, he's cut off, right? So he stops confirming the covenant because he's dead. But he's got to do it for 7 years, so he's got another 3.5 years, allegedly, to confirm. Ooh, wonder when that will be. And I've never seen a fully satisfactory answer. A very popular answer is that when Jesus went to heaven, working through his apostles. So it's now indirect, if you like, it's not Jesus personally, but working through the apostles, they sort of focused on the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem for maybe 3.5 years, depends how you count it, up until the time when Stephen was martyred. And at that point, they sort of turned away from the Jewish leaders and no longer pursued them. And that's the 3.5 years. Never been very persuaded by that, because you know, plenty of other Jews came into the church for years and years afterwards. I'm not really persuaded by that. Another view is the 3.5 years is going to take place in the place of safety, because the true church of God, as Philadelphians, not that lot of Laodiceans, will be in the place of safety, and Jesus will either personally or through his end time leader, sort of maybe do something for 3.5 years. You know, a bit speculative. And the other is that, when Jesus comes back for the second time in the millennium, that the first 3.5 years he will finish off what he started. Don't know. He's got 1,000 years to, don't know whether the first 3.5 is somehow different. But anyway, those are the views. I don't find any particularly convincing. The alternative view, the one I was probably leaning more to, is that he who confirms the covenant is the Antichrist chappie. It was a 7-year treaty with Daniel's people, because it's addressed to Daniel and his people, so the Jews, the leaders in Jerusalem, the government in Jerusalem. And after 3.5 years, he reneges and sets up the abomination, cancels the sacrifices, and then, you know, in the vernacular, all hell breaks loose. Well, okay, maybe we have to leave both options on the table, because prophecy can be difficult. But for me, the Antichrist option seems a lot stronger, because, first of all, context. You know, context is always the main way to understand anything. What we see in Daniel 9:27 is sacrifices are stopped, abomination is erected. Do we find that anywhere else in Daniel? Yes, we do. We're not turning there, but we saw it in Daniel 11:31. Sacrifices are stopped, abomination is installed. Daniel 12, verse 11, sacrifices are stopped, abomination is installed. It happens together. The sacrifices being halted, the abomination being installed, is at the same time by the same wicked person. So therefore, to me, Daniel 9:27, is just the third, version of what we see in Daniel 11 and 12. So to me, the context says it's the same event. It's the same story. And of course, back in Matthew 24, Jesus says, when you see the abomination of desolation, head for the hills. And in terms even of the language, the word abomination in Greek is this rather horrible word to pronounce, bedeligma, B-D-E-L-Y-G-M-A. The word desolation in the Greek is eremosis, E-R-E-M-O-S-I-S. That word is the word that appears in Matthew 24:15, the abomination of desolation. And those words appear in Daniel, in the Greek version of Daniel, the Septuagint. In Daniel 12, 11, and 9. So, surely it's the same event. There's also the question of grammar. We won't belabor that because people might argue with that. There's also, like I mentioned just a few moments ago, the mystery of, if Jesus confirmed his covenant for 3.5 years, what's happened to the other 3.5 years? And there's, like I said, a few ideas, but not convincing. And then equally last week I said, actually, people say, Jesus confirmed the covenant in his physical ministry of 3.5 years, and he's got a bit more to come. Well, actually, it's not even certain that Jesus had a physical ministry for 3.5 years, because many gifted scholars will tell you more like 15 to 18 months. Some will say 2.5 years. Some will go up to 3 years. Some, of course, very popularly say 3.5 years. So if it wasn't 3.5 years in reality, and that is definitely not agreed upon, then, of course, that whole idea about Jesus having a half 7-year period for his ministry really disappears. If his ministry was only 2 years, 2.5 years, then that's got no meaning, has it?
There you go, Mr. Coulter.
And then, of course, you've got the structure, which is that the 70 weeks are divided into 7, 62, and 1 unit at the end, 7-year unit. It's not 7, 62 and a half, and a half at the very end. It's not 7, 62, a half. At the end of the story, there's 1 unit of 7. So anyway, let's not go over all that again and again. It does seem to me pretty suggestive that there is a final 7-year unit with a major event taking place halfway through that. The sacrifices will be stopped. An abomination of desolation will be erected or installed. And then, according to Jesus, in Matthew 24:15, we kick off the great tribulation. And if this is right, then it's probably worth looking out for that event, isn't it? Because don't forget, Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, then do this. So we should see it. If we're looking for it, we might even see the beginning of the 7 years, although, you know, sometimes treaties are tucked away and hidden behind scenes, all very confidential. So we might miss that, not too sure. And just in passing, interesting that Scripture here talks about, I believe, this Antichrist chappie having a 7-year treaty where he, I guess, offers some sort of peace to the Jews. It so happens that in Islam, right, Islam end times prophecy, and they have got it, by the way, they're looking for their Redeemer to come at the end of the days. They call him their Mahdi, M-A-H-D-I, their Mahdi, the Mahdi. He is their version of the returning Messiah. He is their Redeemer. He's going to be their world leader. And you know what? Most of their prophecies, Islam's prophecies, say that this Mahdi, this returning world leader, will usher in a 7-year period of peace. So if you're a gambling man, which I'm not, you might say, do you think that he who confirms the covenant for 7 years is what is actually the Antichrist, but Islam believes it's their Mahdi? Is that possible? I think so, personally. But, you know, time will tell. Anyway, we got that far last week then, and we were really running out of time. Because if the he is, you know, Antichrist, or that type of person, is he going to be a Roman? A European? Because if he is, that would sort of, I guess, suggest our traditional views might be stronger. Or who would he more likely be, Islamic? Would that be a better fit? Well, look at Daniel 9:26. This is where we were last week when I was running out of time rapidly. After 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And notice, here's the key bit, I think. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. So the people who destroy the city and the sanctuary, it'll be from those people that the prince comes. I don't know if that's clear. The people who destroy the city and the sanctuary, they are the people from whom the end time prince comes. So we can identify the people who destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. It is from those people that we look for this end time ruler, commander, who confirms the covenant, and then etc. So, who destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD in the temple? And the answer is, well, the Romans? It sort of is the answer. Certainly the guy in charge was General Titus. He was the Roman leader. I think his father became emperor, so he was definitely a Roman. Interestingly, according to the Josephus, who was there at the time and witnessed all this, Josephus did say that when the temple caught fire, that General Titus and his immediate sort of team did run to the temple to try and protect it, to try and drag their legions off of destroying it, because it was a beautiful building, it was important to the nation, and Titus did not want to see it destroyed. Unfortunately, he was too late. By that stage, the bloodlust was up in the legions. There was also a lot of gold in the temple, and the guys were after that. So, if you like, the key Roman did not want this to happen. His armies did, and they were out of control by this stage. There were four Roman legions there at the time, legions 5, 12, 15, and 10, or V, X, II, XV, and X, because it's Latin, don't forget. Now, these were Roman legions made up of Roman soldiers, but there's a little subtlety here, because the Romans didn't actually send Romans out from Italy and Rome to fight, typically, in far-off battles. Didn't need to. They held them back for, if you like, you know, major wars. What they did do was they conscripted people locally, because it made a lot more sense. And it so happens that the people who destroyed the sanctuary and the city were not Romans by birth. They were not Romans by really nationality. They were not Italians. They were not Europeans. According to Josephus, the legions who actually carried out the devastation were made up of Arabians and Syrians. And by the way, Arabia and Syria are both Islamic countries today. History, there's actually quite a lot of detail about the legions, who controlled them, where they came from. And that tells us that those four legions were made up predominantly of Syrians, Egyptians, Serbians and Bulgarians, but no Romans, no Italians, and predominantly, again, those are Islamic. So interestingly, it tells us there that the people who destroyed the city and the sanctuary were from Arabia, Syria, I think probably is the main one to look at, but certainly nations who were Islamic and, of course, who utterly hated the Jews. That's why it was quite such a carnage as it was. Once Titus lost control of these people who were, you know, mega anti-Semites, then he just couldn't stop them. They wanted to, you know, devastate, kill, maim, destroy, get the gold. So the prince, who will be the Antichrist, who will confirm the covenant, who will stop the sacrifices, who will erect the abomination, comes from, I'm going to guess here, Syria, maybe Arabia. I'm putting my money on Syria as a gambling man, but certainly not from Rome, not from Germany. Okay? And you might say, well, I don't know about that. Surely Romans are Romans are Romans are Romans, aren't they? Well, no, actually, the Bible even shows us an example of this. Look at Acts 22. Acts 22, verses 24 to 29. Nothing to do with prophecy, but in terms of who is a Roman. But you might be thinking I'm making this up. You wouldn't, but you might. Cutting into Luke's story, poor old Paul once again has been arrested for preaching the truth, and so he's about to be severely beaten. We'll cut into the comments there. The commander, verse 24, ordered Paul to be brought into the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging. That's painful. So that he might know why they shouted so against him. That's the Jews. And as they bound him with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who stood by, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman when uncondemned?" Hey, can you do that? Are you going to scourge me? I've had no trial, and I'm a Roman? When the centurion heard that, he went and told the commander, saying, "Take care what you do, for this man is a Roman." And of course, if you treated a Roman, you know, incorrectly, without due process, you'd probably lose your head, lose something probably. The commander came and said to Paul, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" He said, "Yes." Now, Paul's not telling a lie. Paul is a Roman. And he's happy to say that when he's in, you know, trouble. "I'm a Roman." The commander answered, "With a large sum, I obtained this citizenship." You could buy your way into being a Roman citizen. Paul said, "I was born a citizen. I was born a Roman." Then immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him. "Get away quick. This guy can get us all into severe trouble." And the commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman because he had bound him. Okay, so what's the point there? The point is that Paul definitely, absolutely, was a Roman. You could call Paul a Roman. Legally speaking, Paul could say, I'm a Roman. He could defend himself in serious trouble with saying, I'm a Roman. How dare you treat me, a Roman, that way? Well, hang a second. Paul was known previously as Saul of Tarsus. Tarsus isn't in Italy. Tarsus is in southeast Turkey or Asia Minor. So Paul's not a Roman by birth, is he? He's Turkish, I guess, or, you know, Asian, something like that. Equally, of course, Paul is a Jew. He's a Benjamite. He's a Hebrew of Hebrews. So you see, the point is that somebody who's described as a Roman doesn't have to come from Rome or even Europe. You may have Roman legions. They may be called Roman soldiers. This is a label they would carry. But ethnically, the Roman legions who destroyed the sanctuary and the city were Syrian, Arabian, Egyptian, and Nemean, which are, of course, Islamic countries today, and from whom the prince will come. So, again, I'll repeat, always some caution when you're looking at prophecy. But this individual, the he of 927, does certainly appear to be Islamic. And you might then ask, well, would the Jews be this stupid? Would Israel, the state of Israel, and the Jews in Jerusalem really enter into a covenant with a sort of charismatic Islamic ruler? Because isn't there a huge hostility? Don't they want to drive the Jews into the sea? Would they do that in exchange for an offer of peace? Well, you might think it's stupid, but we saw last week one place that it sort of hints at that pretty strongly. Let's turn there again, Isaiah 28, because it does seem strange, but you know, people do stupid things. You and I do. States do as well. So Isaiah 28, let's read verses 14 and 15. Therefore, hear the word of the Lord, you scornful men who rule this people who are in Jerusalem. So, look, this is the government, the leaders in the city of Jerusalem. So let's apply that to these end times and to Daniel 9. Because you have said, you Jewish leaders, we have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we're in agreement. When the overflowing scourge passes through, and I think that's pointing towards the Great Tribulation, it will not come to us. Now this is, you know, utter foolishness. They've made a covenant with death, with Sheol, so that when the scourge goes out, they'll be protected. Are they that daft? Drop down to verse 18 and 19. God says, your covenant with death will be annulled. Your agreement with Sheol will not stand. And of course, Daniel 9:27 says, halfway through it, sacrifice is stopped, abomination set up. Jesus says, at that point, the tribulation gets underway. So the covenant is annulled. When the overflowing scourge / tribulation passes through, then you will be trampled down by it. As often as it goes out, it will take you. For morning by morning, it will pass over, and by day and by night, it will be a terror just to understand the report. Just to hear the news reports will be horrific because of the destruction and devastation, because this covenant that they make with death is annulled, and the scourge does pass through them. So that does seem to be a bit of a hint, and it's certainly end time, because look at verse 5 there. The whole passage, in that day, the Lord of hosts will be for a crown of glory and a diadem of beauty. In that day is a phrase that typically means the end time. So I'm seeing that as a covenant of death in the end time. Okay, so that's where we got to last week. So let's move on, with a few minutes left this week, to Daniel 7. So we're spending a lot of time in Daniel, but hopefully it's going to be worthwhile. Daniel 7. We're going to go through the entire chapter. I'm not sure we'll do all of that today. Well, I'm pretty sure we won't, but let's get as far as we can. Daniel 7 and verse 1 through to 14, and we'll pause there for a bit, I guess. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts, and here they come. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. So we've often said, you know, one thing we can certainly be familiar with is a narrative. What do the scriptures actually say? Now, what it means, usually at that point we start to get into some speculation, guesswork, whatever. And that's always, you know, more caution required. But certainly all of us should know the text, the narrative. I mean, by now, if somebody says, what's in Daniel 2, you should say, big statue, gold, silver, bronze, legs, all the stuff, big stone, all the rest of it. What's in Daniel 8? Ram charging about, he-goat charging about in the end time. Okay, fair enough. What's in Daniel 9? 70 weeks prophecy. Some ambiguity over who the he is, but quite likely it's an Islamic antichrist, seven-year treaty with the Jews, and he reneges in it, and etc. What's in Daniel 7? Well, we'll find out. But equally, we should be able to say eventually, Daniel 7, four beasts, lion, a bear, leopard, and a sort of strange, terrible beast. That's where we should start from, knowing the narrative. What it means, I accept, becomes a little bit less sure, but we do our best, and you know, as time passes, whether we're accurate or wildly inaccurate, will become clearer. But at least we should be looking for something that thinks, oh, yeah, it looks like it's confirming the scripture, or, time to do some more homework. Well, here we are. Here are the four beasts. Verse 4. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. So a beast like a lion. Verse 5. And suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear. It was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. I think one translation says, gorge yourself. After this I looked, and there was another beast like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. So four beasts that we can recognize, a lion or like a lion, something like a bear, something like a leopard, and then, the fourth one. Daniel says, after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful, terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, what could all this be about? Verse 8, I was considering the horns and the 10 horns, that would be, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this odd horn were eyes, like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous words. So it's all quite clear, isn't it? You know, strange, hard to describe beast with 10 horns and a little horn with eyes and a mouth, which you see every day. Verse 9. I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow. The hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, and its wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, or judgment was seated, and the books were opened. I watched then, because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking, I watched till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. So Daniel's vision takes him right down to, actually, to the kingdom of God, to the world tomorrow. Because here he sees the end of this fourth beast, that the court has just taken its place. They've clearly evaluated and judged. And then at this point, the beast is taken, slain, destroyed, verse 12. As for the rest of the beasts, the one like the lion, the bear, and the leopard, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I was watching the night visions, continues Daniel, and behold, one like the Son of Man, so this would be obviously Jesus the Messiah, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, the Father. They brought him near before him. Then to him, Jesus, Messiah, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. So that's the whole vision, and it takes Daniel right down to, well, to Jesus setting up God's kingdom, which it says there, you know, his kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed. It's an everlasting dominion. So it brings us right back to the end of this age and the beginning of the world tomorrow. So, well, a lot of time passes here, it seems. But let's go back and sort of unpack it. So let's look at the four beasts. That's verses 4 through 7. So one like a lion, one like a bear, one like a leopard, and this strange, dreadful beast with 10 horns. What's that? Well, okay.
In 5 minutes.
we've got 20 minutes yet. The traditional view, right, the one that we're used to, we will say, well, okay, the lion is parallel to the gold statues, the head of the gold statue, so it's Babylon. And my marginal notes, which are totally inspired, my own handwriting, says Babylon. Okay, fair enough. Of course, if I modernise that, that's Iraq, isn't it? Well, it is. It's not a question, really. It is Iraq. Yeah. The bear, well, according to my inspired marginal notes, that parallels the silver chest of the statue, which is clearly Medo-Persia, or, nowadays, modern language, Iran. Of course, by the way, Iraq's Muslim and Iran is Muslim, so interesting. If you apply this to today, we're talking of Islamic nations. Down to the leopard, well, again, my inspired marginal notes. It says Greece with four divisions. Well, I know the four divisions is definitely uninspired. And Greece, I think we've said before, probably now we're thinking more of Turkey. And then the nasty beast with the 10 horns that jumps about stamping and being very bad-tempered is, historically, Rome, oblique Europe. And then the little horn who pops up, the little horn who pops up is the papacy. Right? That's sort of the traditional view. Only you might be thinking now, well, hang on a second, the fourth beast we said before quite possibly is actually the Islamic realm. And the little horn might be the Islamic Antichrist, because that's what we've been more or less saying. So, you know, maybe we can keep our options open here, because it is prophecy, we see through a glass darkly, but there's a few issues I've probably got here with Rome. If you look at these countries today, we're going to say the lion is Babylon, Iraq, Muslim. The bear is Medo-Persia, Iran, Muslim. The leopard is Turkey, Muslim. The fourth beast is Rome, which is Christian Western Europe. As a sequence, Muslim, 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 Christian Western Europe. Okay. Maybe, but it does sort of seem a little bit sort of, you know, odd. The 10 horns, verse 7. This terrible beast has 10 horns. What are they? Well, historically, traditionally, we've said that that these 10 horns are 10 kingdoms that arose out of the Roman Empire. So we said the Roman Empire suffered a deadly wound. We'll cover that another week, right? But this is what we've all tended to sign up to, so this shouldn't be a surprise to you. What we said was that the fourth beast had a deadly wound, which we believed was in 476 AD with the fall of the Roman Empire. I'll come back to that. And out of this Roman Empire came 10 horns or 10 kingdoms, sort of one by one by one, not all at once. So 10, if you like, sort of resurrections of the fatally wounded Roman Empire. And the 10 horns, the 10 kings were, and if I give you a test, would you get them all? Number 1 was the Vandals. Number 2 was the Heruli, H-E-R-U-L-I. Number 3 was the Ostrogoths, O-S-T-R-O, Goths. And those are the three that were plucked up by this little pompous horn. Then the empire was restored, sort of, under Justinian. So number 4 of these 10 horns was Justinian. Number 5 was Charlemagne. Number 6 was Otto the Great. Number 7 was Charles the Great. Number 8 was Napoleon, getting into more recent times now. Number 9 was Italy under Garibaldi, 1870 to 1945, if you're interested. And number 10 is yet to come. That's the final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, which will comprise 10 other dictators. Now, that's a story that you've
believed,
accepted and believed, as I have as well, by the way, so I'm not pointing any fingers. And we've even got charts on it. I've opened mine up at the moment. I've got this chart here from Ambassador College Bible Correspondence Course, Lesson 31, which is a decent-sized chart, and it lists all these 10 horns, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. It lists all those people I just mentioned to you. So that's, there's some information there to look at. That's the traditional view. It may be right. I'm uncomfortable in saying that because I don't find it very persuasive in some ways. I mean, first of all, a lot of it's built upon the Roman Empire falling in 476 AD. Well, really, technically, properly, it didn't fall in 476 AD. The western part of the Roman Empire definitely fell about then, but the Roman Empire spread way east, and the capital was Constantinople. And that continued for 1,000 more years, and that was the Roman Empire. It was the Ottomans who destroyed that in 1453 when they took over Constantinople, or Istanbul, as it's called today. So anything built around the fall of Rome, not really comfortable. It didn't really. That's why I said, somewhat jokingly, that if the iron legs symbolize the Western Eastern Roman Empire, then one leg got chopped off in 476, and it was standing in one leg for 1,000 years. Because the other leg didn't get chopped down until 1453. Not really convinced. And then I think a little bit, I'm not a historian, but I do wonder a wee bit about choosing those individuals as the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, etc. Yeah. Horn. There were other kings and emperors. So, I don't know. I'm a little bit unpersuaded by that.
You've got to make something up.
Now, the alternative view, of course, is that this terrible beast, the fourth beast, is actually the Islamic realm. Because that's consistent with what we said, Daniel 2, the fourth empire. Because look at verse 7, and you'll recognize the emphasis I'm going to give here, I think. After this I saw in the night visions, behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. Breaking in pieces, devouring. trampling down the residue till there's nothing left. Well, if the terrible beast is the Roman Empire, let's ask the same question as in Daniel 2. Did the Roman Empire crush, pulverize, break in pieces, and trample into the dust in terms of, you know, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece? The answer is no, it didn't. We covered that in enormous depth. It actually tended to build up other countries. And it, for example, it never at any point never crushed Medo-Persia. It barely made any inroads into Babylon. So actually, Rome doesn't do this, but Islam does. The Islamic realm pulverizes, destroys. It destroys culture, destroys your history. It changes your education system. It changes your laws. It wipes out any country religions. So actually, Islam fits much better there, the Islamic realm, than does Rome. Let's drop down. Now, verses 9 through 10, it talks about, you know, thrones were put in place, Ancient of Days was seated. Verse 10, it talks about the court was seated, the books are opened. Now, I've got an inspired marginal reference to the Great White Throne Judgment. I've probably got to delete that, because in context, we're talking here about the four beasts and the end of the age. The Great White Throne Judgment doesn't come for 1,000 years after that. So I think I've picked up something there from an old correspondence course lesson that might not be entirely valid. It might be a type, you know, where, if you like, the books are opened at the end of the millennium to judge people. I get that. But in context, and we should respect the context, this is all in the context of the four beasts, and particularly the fourth one. So if you've got a reference like I've got to the Great White Throne Judgment, I'd probably put just a question mark or two sort of behind that. Now look at the verses 5 and 6. Because we spent a lot of time in Daniel 8 looking at the ram and its warlike rampage and the eventual counterattack of the he-goat. And what I think we're seeing here, I'll suggest we're seeing here, is that Daniel chapter 8 and those two animals that fight is really what we're seeing in verses 5 and 6, but expanded upon. Now let me show you why. Verse 5. Suddenly another beast, a second like a bear. I'm going to say that this is the second. It's Medo-Persia, which is Iran. Iran, of course, is the ram of the next chapter, chapter 8. Chapter 8 is end time, we saw. The ram goes on the rampage, does it not? If you remember Daniel 8, the ram had two horns. One came up later, but became the bigger horn. We said, speculating, that might well be the supreme leader, the Ayatollah, and perhaps the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which was set up afterwards, but prophetically it looks like it might become the most dominant force in Iran. Well, look at the bear. The bear, I'm pretty sure, is Medo-Persia / Iran today. It was raised up on one side. Okay, so one side is higher than the other. One horn was higher than the other. Okay, seems to fit. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. Three ribs? Well, I wonder if you saw the picture of the bear like Daniel did, you might see the ribs pointing in maybe three directions. Speculating. But what we saw in Daniel 8 was the ram rushes out and attacks to the north, the south, and the west. Not the east. North, south, and west. Three directions. So maybe the three ribs are actually sticking out at different angles from the bear's mouth. So it's raised up on one side. One side is higher than the other. The two horns of Daniel 8, one is higher than the other. Three directions, three ribs. And it says, arise, devour much flesh. Get out there and gorge. And of course, what we saw in the ram of the next chapter is, yeah, it did whatever it wanted for a while. So there's, you know, quite a lot of commonality there, as you'd expect. Because I believe Daniel 8 is simply expanding on the brief details here. What about the leopard, verse 6? Because that would seem to be the counterattack by Turkey, Javan in the Hebrew, Ionia, Western Asia Minor, Turkey of today. And of course, more detail given to us there in Daniel 8. And the leopard I've got here in my margin, Greece. Well, it is, you know, probably Turkey in actuality. But what we've got here, it says, verse 6, after this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on his back four wings of a bird, give it, I guess, great speed, perhaps carry it through the air. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Well, what we said last time in Daniel 8 was that the he-goat, which has a notable horn, counterattacks furiously against Iran. And I think I said at the time, what you've got there is Turkey heading up a four-nation confederacy. Well, four heads. That's where that comes from. Four heads are four powers who are united together, but the dominant power is going to be Turkey with its own dominant leader. And if this happens the next 3 or 4 years, it won't, but if it did, you know, President Erdogan would be the sort of candidate you're looking for. It says four wings. Well, that suggests speed. Or it may be a reference to this as an airborne attack. Because in Daniel 8:5, not turning to it, talking to the he-goat, it says that he comes across the surface of the earth without touching the ground. And that may just imply tremendous speed. So you're scooting over the ground. Or maybe it's a hint of some airborne attack. So there seems a very good parallel between Daniel 7 and 8 insofar as the bear and the leopard are expanded upon in Daniel 8. And we've got all the details I think we needed there at the time. And don't forget, Daniel 8 was in the end time, at the end of the days, for many years to come. Okay, so let's continue. Right, let's pick up in Daniel 15 through 18, then we'll probably pause for today.
Daniel 7, 15 to 18.
Daniel 7, 15 to 18. Daniel 7, if you're still with me, verses 15 to 18, at which point we'll pause this week. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit, within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me.
They would me as well.
Yeah, I guess they would, because these were scary, particularly the fourth one. And you'll see next week now that he's particularly interested in this fourth beast. You know, he sort of somehow gets the first sort of three, the one like a lion, like a bear, like a leopard. But the fourth one, this one's really causing him some distress. But anyway, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit, verse 15, within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Those great beasts which are four kings which arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. That's a pretty brief summary. Verse 17, 18. There are four kings, four kingdoms which will arise out of the earth, and then it's God's kingdom, and the saints will rule. That's summarizing everything in two verses, pretty sharp. Well done to that angel. But here's the thing. Verse 17, it doesn't read quite right, I don't believe, in my New King James Version, which is what I'm using, because it says here, talking of these four beasts, right? The one like a lion, the one like a bear, the one like a leopard, the one that's too horrible to describe properly. It says, these four are four kings or kingdoms which arise out of the earth. And it doesn't say that. It's actually in the future tense. The King James Version says, four kings which shall arise out of the earth, which shall arise. The NET translation says, four kings who will arise. The NIV, nearly inspired version, says four kings that will rise. The RSV, four kings who shall arise. So what's the problem? Well, the vision is of four kings, kingdoms, nations, which shall arise. You can't say that about ancient Babylon because it was just about to end. You can't say it's about to arise. Look at Daniel 7 verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had this vision. Well, Belshazzar was the last king of Babylon. Babylon's just about over. Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold, has been dead for years. So when it says in verse 17, these four great beasts are four kings which shall yet arise, it cannot be talking of really ancient Babylon because it was not only long since arisen, it was just about time to disappear. So therefore, all of this is future. Just like Daniel 8 was for the end time. Just like in Daniel 12, the angel said, seal these things up, Daniel, for it refers to the end time. It's for many, many days from now. You go your way, you sleep in peace, you'll rise up at the end of the days. So actually, although very often people try to apply these four beasts to ancient Babylon, can't do that. I don't think you can do that anyway, because Daniel, verse 17 here, says these four kings will arise, and I'm taking that to be a sort of a hint that the passage in Daniel 7, like Daniel 8, like Daniel 9, 27, like Daniel 12, this is all about the end times in our day. Well, okay, well, once again, we've run out of sort of time, so let's conclude there, and we'll pick it up again at that point next week.